start the talk now, so I can please have all the teddy bears sitting up, paying attention. That's more better. Be respectful. So, for this morning's talk, again, still going on the same subject on how to meditate, but bringing some of those teachings on meditation into your daily life and your daily life into meditation, is for those of you who have studied traditional Buddhism, they always call the problems things like greed, hatred, delusion, guilt, fear, worry, feelings of revenge, and even the hindrances to meditation, things like sensory desire and again ill will. A lot of those things, you ask, where do they live? Are they in you? Are they in, say, the objects of your anger? I often reflected that because when I used to get angry at people, I could never figure out why no one else could see what I did and got angry at the same person. I thought they were a terrible person, but other people actually loved them. I couldn't understand that. So as if they were really a bad person, why doesn't everybody hate them? And if they're just a wonderful person, why doesn't everybody love them? And some people don't like them. It never made sense to me. And of course, even it can't be in them. If anger was in them, then everyone would hate them. If like kindness was in, if love was in them, then everyone would love them. So was it in me? And if it was in me, then I'd always be angry at them. I'd always love them. And I realized after a while that it's not in me. All the defilements in life are not inside of you. They don't live with other people or other things. They live in that space between you and the object. It's called relationship. And what you put between you and the object of life, or in this particular case, the object of meditation. That is where those defilements live. So it's not like the breath is restless. It's not you are restless. You put restlessness in between the two of you because you've got a bad relationship to it. And I've already mentioned this with the breath. If your relationship to your breath is one of master and slave, that is not a very good relationship to have. So instead we change what's between us, or the watcher if you like, the knower, between the knower and the breath to be something which is much more friendly and kind. So I always say that whatever meditation object you have, always put some kindness, some friendliness between you and the object. So you look at the object like a good friend. And if you look at your breath like a good friend, just I often say, you'd love hanging out with them. My simile of this is a simile of the coffee shop. It's like you have a free afternoon and someone gives you a call on your iPhone and they say, are you free this afternoon? And you say yes. If anyone ever asks you that, say why, first of all, before you say yes. Are you free this afternoon? You say yes. Oh, great. Please come and have a cup of coffee with me in my favorite coffee shop. And I know you like latte, but latte is full of milk and oil. It's bad for your health. You're going to have a short black, because that's what I like. And I know you like chocolate chip muffins, but they make you fat, so have a biscuit instead, like what I like. And we're going to sit in the back, not in the front where you like, because the back is much more secluded. And we're going to talk about Mr. Trump and the political situation in the United States. I know you like to talk about Buddhism nonsense, but this is more important. This is the world is at stake, so we're going to talk about Mr. Trump. And we're going to sit there for 1.5 hours, because that's all the time I have. Not shorter than that, but just that. And if you receive a call like that from someone who tells you what coffee shop you're going to go to, what you're going to drink and eat, where you're going to sit and what you're going to talk about for how long. Would you want to go? And the answer is no. You'd find any excuse you can possibly make up to not go with such a control freak. So you say, I have to go to the dentist. I'm terribly sorry. Maybe some other day. And to keep your precepts of not lying, as soon as you hang up, you quickly ring the dentist and make an appointment. And after you're making your appointment with the dentist, you get another phone call from another friend. They said, are you free this afternoon? He said, oh, I just made an appointment with the dentist. Oh, they said, because I know you have that coffee shop you've always been talking about where the lattes are to die for. Literally. And the chocolate chip muffins are just so amazingly delicious. And you always like sitting in the front. And I usually like sitting in the back, but I sit in the front just to see what it's like. You say it's so much more fun up there. And you know, you've always been talking about this Buddhism and meditation and spirituality stuff. Actually, you know, I'm interested. So, you know, can you tell me something about Buddhism? And if that is what they say, they want to go to your coffee shop where you like to go, drink what you like to drink, eat what you like to eat, and talk about what interests you. What happened? You say, I'm cancelling the appointment. I'll see you there soon. And even though you've only got an hour and a half to spend, you end up spending all afternoon there, 3-4 hours. The time flies by. Because you're not with a control freak anymore. You're with a kindness freak. Someone who's kind to you. And that's why you like hanging out with them. And I'm sure you've understood what the simile means. It's not going to a coffee shop. It's going to the meditation hall in China Grove. Come on, let's go to the meditation hall in China Grove. And he said, you're going to sit on the floor because that's where I think you should sit. And you're not going to sit on a chair, okay? I don't care if you hurt. You're going to sit on the floor. That's where real meditators sit. And you are going to watch the breath. You're not going to sort of scan the body or do any of this other rubbish. Go right to the heart of it. And you are not going to sit how you like to sit. You're going to hug a teddy bear because that's what I like you to hug. And you're going to sit for 1 hour. Not 50 minutes, 1 hour. That's what people say to their minds when they want to meditate. They tell them body and mind where they're going to sit, how they're going to do it, for how long, what they're going to do. A total control freak. And that's one wonder your meditation doesn't work. Your attitude to meditation, your relationship to it, is all of like master and slave to your body and mind. So instead, try the other person. You walk into this meditation, not even walk into the meditation hall. You say, where do you want to meditate today? In your room, on the stupa, in the hall here, or somewhere else? Where do you want to meditate? Not telling your body and mind where to go. And where do you want to sit? On a chair, on the floor? Do you want to do some walking meditation, mind? And what do you want to watch? Don't tell it what to eat and what to drink. You ask your mind what it wants. And you find, don't say how long, 50 minutes, an hour and a half. Because when you treat your mind like a best friend and you care for your body, you say, well, I was actually going to take a rest, but seeing as you're like that, yeah, I'm coming. And you do more meditation and you sit much longer because you're enjoying the company of a very best friend. It's not master-slave relationship anymore. It's two friends who respect one another. And that's why you can stay together for long periods of time. So this is an example of just sometimes we have the wrong relationship to our mind and body, thinking we're going to train it like some drill sergeant and the new recruit. And you find that is not Buddhism, that's military. That is not kindness, that's force. And you find after a while you rebel, the mind rebels. And you know what it does when it rebels? It starts thinking fantasies, old movies, where you're going to go next, writing your autobiography, whatever it is goes, oh, a last resort, falling asleep. Anything to get away from you. And when it gets into the morning and you wake up, I'm not going to go to that hall again. Not more meditation. Not more this is what should be done. How many more sadhu, sadhu, sadhus do we have to do in this place? If you force a mind like that, of course it rebels. But, and if you ask the mind, hey mind, what do you want to do? And if it says, I want some more sleep, okay, turn over and have some more sleep. Because what happens next is the mind thinks, wow, this person cares for me, she likes me. And therefore you like to spend time together. So what happens is you wake up and the mind says, yeah, let's go to the hall, do some meditation. Yeah, let's do some. In other words, you're working together in a beautiful relationship with your mind. Which means you actually meditate much more. It's a strange thing. When I first started teaching meditation, just do it the same as everybody else did. Up at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock. 5:30, everybody in the hall. 6 o'clock, some chanting. And 7 o'clock, breakfast. 7, 8 o'clock, talk. After the talk, 5 minutes, toilet break, and then back in the hall. Every minute was scheduled. And the result of that was people got very tense, and also at the end of the day, they couldn't get to bed fast enough. Now there's no schedule. It does mean that when you want to have a rest, you can have a rest. But you know you can come in here any time, morning, afternoon, night time, and meditate. And you find people staying in here meditating late at night because they're not afraid of having to get up early in the morning. Working with nature is so much more productive. Get more meditation, deeper meditation, because you've got a much better relationship with time. In other words, time is under your control. It doesn't control you. That's also one of the reasons why we don't have a bell to wake you up in the morning. They have that in some retreats. Bang, 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 bang. And then bang again. That drives you crazy. And you have a bell for before breakfast, a bell before lunch, a bell after lunch to wake you up, the bell. Bells all through the day. It's just like being at school again. But, here comes a terrible joke which I have to say every retreat. In this retreat, we keep what is called no bell silence. No bells. And because we keep no bell silence, many of you will win the Nobel Peace Prize. The jhana. That's the Nobel Peace Prize. You can only do that when you're allowed to let the mind just have a free rein and it will want to get peaceful. That's what it inclines towards if you give it half a chance. It loves peace, it loves silence, it loves just to be here, aware and just enjoying this moment. So, the relationship even with time. But one of the core teachings I want to do with relationships this morning is a very powerful relationship story, which many of you know. It's a core story in Opening the Door of Your Heart. But it's also a great way of answering many of your questions on meditation. It's the Old Emperor's Three Questions story. It's a very brilliant story, and I'm still exploring more ways of adapting that to situations in life, especially situations in meditation. In brief, the story was an emperor was fed up with religion. They were always fighting each other, or arguing, or blowing each other up. And so, religion does have some advantages, though. Like the person, some of you know these old jokes, but here we go. Like the person over in Sydney, who had a nice house, but was really, really upset with how much he had to pay on insurance. Because there's lots of robbers and thieves in Sydney. And even if he paid a huge amount of money for insurance, he also was, they insisted that he put this really strong security locks on all his doors and windows, especially the upper story windows, and to put sort of CCTV cameras and have them monitored. You know, all the stuff you have to put in your house these days, which makes it like a prison. And he really didn't like that, but that's the only way you could get insurance. And so one day he had a brilliant idea, and he gave away all his security cameras, he didn't lock his doors, he didn't need any grills on his windows, and he had 24/7 security all for free. All he did is he went to Bunnings, he bought a flagpole, and he managed on the internet to buy an ISIS flag. And he put that on top of his flagpole in his front garden, and now he has 24/7 surveillance by the federal police, by ACO, and even the CIA, all for free. And he doesn't have to pay anything for that. So anyway, that's an old joke. It's a good one. So, this guy was, this monarch was fed up with religion. So, if you're an emperor and a boss, make up your own religion. That's one of the perks of being sort of a king, like Henry VIII. He didn't like Catholicism because it stopped him getting married and divorcing and cutting off the heads of his wife. So he actually formed his own Anglican religion. It's quite a smart move, really. Although, you know, not something I would sort of say was very ethical. But anyway, you know what else he did, which was, you know, he was running out of money like most governments are. So, you know, once he sort of changed the religion, he got all these Catholic monasteries and sold them off. And that's where he made a lot of money from. Really sort of a very good economist. And Donald Trump should actually study him. Anyway, now where was I going? Oh, yes, the emperor. And the emperor's three questions. So eventually he found out, religion, all you ever really need, you don't need to know about the origin of the universe and the nature of death or anything like that. Just keep it practical. And the practical question is, when is the most important time? Who is the most important person? What's the most important thing to do? You know, just the when, the who, and the what. Now, Ajahn Chah gave the answer to why. So actually the emperor, you know, missed that one out. That was Ajahn Chah. He came back later on. But when, who, and what? What to do? And, of course, you all know the answer to those questions. The most important time, when, is now. It's always now. So forget about how many days there are left on this retreat. Sometimes we go, oh, what day is the day? It's Friday. So Saturday, Sunday, only a couple of days left. Ah! I haven't got anything yet. Ah! What am I going to tell my friends? Ah! Don't say 2 days. Say it's 48 hours. Say that is 2,880 minutes. That is 100, come on. That's a lot of seconds. It's over, was it 150,000 seconds? Yeah, something like that. And only 1 second, that's all you need to get in line. You've got 150,000 opportunities. You haven't even come close to the end of the retreat yet. But when you start, you know, getting lost in time, because I said this last night, you create time in a much more fundamental way than you think. And if you start worrying about, ooh, only a couple of days to go now, you'll be packing your bags this morning. I don't know why people do that. They haven't even left yet. Now before they go on holiday, they pack their bags a week before. They get to the holiday hotel, and a week before they leave, they pack their bags. They only stay a week in the hotel, even though they're there for 2 weeks. It's absolutely crazy stuff, people. But so now is the most important time. So forget about every meditation you've ever had in your past. It doesn't count at all. It's done, finished. Another person, non-self. So, and all the time in the future, forget about that. Now is the only time you ever have. So if you ever really understand that, there's no revenge, there's no anger, there's no disappointment. Disappointment is about the past. Expectation is about the future. Imagine, no disappointment, no expectation. What's left? Peace in the present moment. So now is the most important, so important in meditation. Don't even worry about what you're going to do next. Now is the most important time. And I'll go to the third question. The most important thing to do is to care. And this, I'm going to go on the usual tangent when I say what it means to care. Because there was one of these young Sri Lankan men here. I don't mind. You know, Siri Niranjala, their son, Sumetha. It was his story. Sumetha Galhemagi. And anyway, they come here when their kids were small. They came to the temple, and he sort of would always come to the temple and always give him advice throughout his career as a student at university and then as a doctor. He was the one who came up to me and said that I have to resign because one of his patients had died tragically. It was a young woman. And, you know, number one, he felt really guilty that, you know, he was under his care. He was their doctor. And he failed them. She died. And she was a young woman. So he had to go and tell the husband that he had no more wife. They were still, you know, really young, loved each other terribly. And also tell him that his two children had no more mother. And that was just really hurt him, he said. I can still remember just the way he said it, which was, I can't do that anymore. I can't stand that. And that's when I told him that you've forgotten, or you didn't even were told in the first place, what the main purpose of being a doctor is. It's not to cure your patients. That's not why you're in this profession. If you think to cure is why you're a doctor, you will go through this so many times in your life. You will fail many times because not even the best doctors can cure people. We're always going to die anyway. They just put off dying for a few more years. That's all that doctors ever achieve. But eventually they all fail to cure. So I said, if that's your, you think what you're here for, you've really missed the point. What you're here to do is not to cure people, but to care for them. And if you care for every patient who comes to you, you never need to fail. You can always care for someone, but you can't always cure them. And even if they do die, knowing they've been cared for, it changes the whole process of death. They've been cared for to the max. And the family, yes, I mean, they're disappointed, but at least they know their loved one was cared for so much in their last days. And I said, and every one of you can understand this, if you make caring much more important than curing, you'll find that many more people under you will get cured. Because caring is such a powerful therapy. And he got it straight away. And so, you know, he's now intestinal doctor. I forget what they're actually called. But anyway, that's what he does. He looks like he spends his days looking up people's colons, giving them endoscopies. He's also a very nice guy. So, caring, not curing. So in your relationship, you've got a husband, a wife, you've got kids, you've got grandparents, you've got your favourite monks. What sort of relationship do you have? Are you going to try and cure them? Are you going to try and cure me of telling stupid jokes? You're wasting your time. Are you going to try? My most stupid joke. Let's see, how many of you, it's on the subject of hospitals, how many of you can remember the carrot joke? Only a couple of you putting your hands up. A few more. Not enough, I'm afraid. Not enough to stop me. This is one of my favourite stupid jokes. Two carrots were walking down the road when one of these drunk drivers lost control of their vehicle, went onto the sidewalk, the footpath, and hit one of the carrots. And he was very badly injured, so the second carrot got out his iPhone and dialed 000, called the ambulance. The ambulance came within a couple of minutes, really fast. And the two medics came out, took one look at the injured carrot and put him right in the back of the ambulance. This was an emergency. And the other carrot, his friend, went along. They got to the hospital in the triage, the nurses took one look at them, straight into surgery. This was life and death. And so the other carrot, his friend, was was in the waiting room. And I've been in those waiting rooms in the ICU, and it's so tense in there because people are worried sick. Any news, any moment, you know, the doctor can come and say he's going to make it, or they're going to say that, I'm sorry, sir, he's dead. They're really on the edge of life and death, and that's why those are some of the most tense places I've ever been, you know, the waiting rooms in the ICU. And anyway, after a couple of hours, the surgeon came in, and he recognized the friend, who's only one more carrot in the hospital that day, and said, Mr. Carrot, I got some good news and bad news about your friend. He said, the good news is we managed to save his life. He's going to survive. He's going to make it. But the bad news is because of his injuries, you know what's coming, don't you? He's going to be a vegetable for the rest of his life. That is my stupid joke. He's a vegetable to begin with. Anyway, no way you're going to cure me of telling that joke even though you've heard it before. The same way you're not going to be able to cure your husband or your wife, are you? You've been trying to do that for years, some of you, and that's why you sort of get terrible relationships. Are you going to try and cure your kids of their bad habits or their stupidity sometimes? Can you do that? Of course not. Because the whole point is not to cure them, but to care for them. Care for your partner, care for your kids, care for your favourite monk. The nuns. Care. I've got to say that as I get in trouble tonight. Care for them, and then you find that changes the whole ballgame. The relationship gets much softer when you're not trying to change people. And also they find they do change much more when you care for them. Now, that is why the most important thing to do is not to cure, is to care. So how does that relate to your meditation? Don't try and cure your mind of all its bad habits. Don't try and cure your restless mind. Don't try and cure your sleepy mind. Care for it. And that changes, again, the ball game. And you'll find the problems which you had now vanish. Because you're caring for your restless mind, caring for your sleepy mind, you will find the restlessness and the sleepiness start to disappear. They vanish. What you are trying to achieve through curing, now you get through caring. And I mentioned why. If you care for someone, they like to hang out with you. They want to pay attention because they're caring for you. So it's the caring is so powerful in the meditation. The same as if you've got any obstacles, even in the deeper meditations, the breath. Oh, you can't keep your awareness on the breath. Care for your breath. That's why sometimes the word is anthropomorphized. You take something which is inanimate, like the breath, and you make it like a being, like a teddy bear. My breath, I'm so grateful for it. It's been coming in and out of my body for 66 years now. Always managing to come in and go out. You know, even if I'm just not paying any attention, if I'm sleeping, if you're under anesthetic, your breath has never failed you once for all the years, ever since you were born. It's come in and out and served you. How about saying thank you to your breath? Showing it some gratitude, showing it some care. Say thank you for all you've done for me. Sometimes I've been running after something, hardly able to breathe because I'm running out of breath, but still the breath manages to get a little bit more oxygen in there to help me. It's always been such a great servant. So I anthropomorphize, I care for my breath. So when I do watch my breath, I have this beautiful relationship. This is one of my best friends. It really has served me. And I feel so grateful for it. So when I watch my breath, it is really with love, this great gratitude and care. Then it's almost impossible to take your awareness off the breath. The attitude you have to, this lovely breath has been so kind to me, thank you so much. And that attitude you have to the breath of caring for it, having gratitude, respecting it, that makes it so easy to watch, with a lot of joy as well. So you can spend hours just being grateful watching this wonderful breath. So you care for it. You don't try and cure it. You don't say, okay, now you've got to settle down, you've got to be peaceful, you've got to get the full awareness. No, don't do that. Care for it. Don't try and cure it. And then all those things come. That's why Ajahn Chah was saying, sit under the mango tree, very still, but also open up your hand, he said. I understand that to mean open up your heart with a lot of care and kindness. Don't try and cure things. And the most important part of those Emperor's Three Questions, yes, now the most important time, the most important thing to do is to care, not cure. Who was the most important person? And that's the one which, when I told this in public and people hadn't heard it before, they would never get that right. They'd always say, myself is the most important. Just such a self-centered society we live in these days. I say, well, who else is the most important? Is it God? Is it Jesus? Is it the Buddha? No. The answer was, the most important person is the one right in front of you right now. And that's such a beautiful answer, because it meant that, when you are coming to have interviews, you sitting in front of me, and I hope you get this, because I've been training on this for such a long time, you are the most important person in the world for me, when you're right in front of me. Only for a few minutes. When you're gone, you're not important anymore. But when you're in front of me, yes, you are important. And that way you can actually give and connect with people. Now, when it's your kids and you're really busy and you're tired and they come up, mummy, 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 when they come up to you, they're important. Okay, another story. This is not a joke, but this is one of the stories. It's in one of those books. It's a great story of our modern times about the six-year-old kid who was waiting for his father to come home from work. Father came home late because he was very busy. And as soon as he came home from work, the little kid asked his daddy, 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 how much do you earn at work? And the father said, look, don't ask stupid questions, I'm tired. But Daddy, how many dollars do you earn at work? Look, I'm telling you, I'm tired. But Daddy, how much do you earn? Right, that's it, three times. Up to your room, you're grounded. And this little six-year-old, just asking a simple question, had to trudge up to his room. And after his father had just had a bit of a rest, had a cup of tea, he realized he was just too hard on his son. When you're really tired, had a busy day at work, you do get grumpy. It's just the stress makes you annoyed at the people you love. So the father, feeling guilty, went up to his son's room, let himself in, and said sorry to his son. Look, I shouldn't have shouted at you. And it's a stupid question, but I shouldn't have shouted. I don't know why you want to know this. I earn $20 an hour at work. And his son smiled and said, thank you, Daddy. Now, can I please borrow $10? And the father would usually shout at his son again, but he'd already shouted enough that evening. So he opened his wallet and gave him $10, almost like as a fine for arguing at his son to repay the debt. So he gave his son a $10 note, and the son smiled and said, thank you, Daddy. And he reached under his pillow and got another $10 in coins, counted out a full 20, gave it to his father and said, now, Daddy, can I please have 1 hour of your time? $20 an hour. I've made a lot of people cry telling that story. Because it really hits down here. We really want to spend time with our kids. So at that particular time, the kid had to pay $20 an hour because that's how much the father earned at work. So, to compete for his time. So that's not really a joke, but that's actually a powerful story to say how important it is to spend time with the people we really care about, because they're right in front of us. So that's great if you are, actually that's, if anyone flew Cathay Pacific here, that I go and give a talk at Cathay Pacific every year, and the head of human resources, that's part of their training now. For everyone who works in Cathay Pacific, especially the flight attendants, empathy questions. So that when on the aircraft, the person right in front of them is the most important person in the world. Service. And of course, if you do things like that, you know, you're going to sort of really come across as flight attendants which really care about you. So anyway, great story. But what's that got to do with a meditation retreat? Now this is really powerful. This is why I like telling this story. What are you aware of right now? Whatever that is the most important meditation object in the whole world. Don't try and get rid of this to get something better. So if you're on some fantasy, if that is in your mind right now, please give it importance. And don't try and cure it, care for it. Whatever's in your mind right now is the most important thing in the whole world. Care for it. It's happening now. Empathy questions. That changes the whole of your meditation. Instead of trying to get rid of the fantasies which actually feed them, you care for them. It's right now. Give it importance. When you give it importance, now you're actually mindful. Part of being mindful is giving importance to what's happening now. If you try and get rid of it, you're not really watching it. You're not investigating it. You're not being with it. You're just trying to get rid of it. You're not really here. So even if it's sleepiness, it's important. For some reason or another, it's there. It's cause and effect. So don't think there's something wrong we have to get rid of. It's important. Be with it and care for it. And then you find the sleepiness doesn't last that long. I know, that's the way I overcame much of my sleepiness. It's just I cared for it. And then it didn't last that long. And when it does come, it's always cause and effect. You didn't sleep well at night. Something's going on in your body or there's some sickness coming. It's just cause and effect. It's nothing to do with you. It's not a personal fault. How can it be a personal fault when there's no one in here? It's just cause and effect, that's all. So you have the breath in mind. Don't try and get rid of that because the more important limiters are coming next. No, this moment, this breath, whatever's happening right now is the most important breath in the whole world. Care for it. Don't try and develop it. Don't try and soften it and make it still and peaceful. Care for it. You're doing your walking meditation. This step happening right now is the most important in the world. And you care for it. That's all. And when nimittas come, don't think, oh, I've got to develop these to get jhanas. No, that's important as it is. So if a nimitta is there, just give it importance. If it wants to go here, there, all over the place, let it. It's important. You don't control people. You care for them. So care for the nimitta. And if you do that, you understand how to meditate. So simple. Powerful, very effective instructions. Now is the only time you ever have. The object in front of you, whatever it is the most important in the whole world. Care for it. That's all. And you'll find you're getting into the deepest meditation really quickly. In order to understand more fully how that works, empathy questions, how it refers to the meditation. Like, you know, even say, let's just go for one more thing. You're sick. In your bed, feeling terrible. Why? Because you want to get rid of the sickness. If you're feeling sick, please, now's the most important time. The sickness is the most important thing in the world for you. So don't try and get rid of it. Care for it. Thank you, sickness. It's wonderful being sick. Because now I'm sick, I don't need to get up in the morning. I can sleep in. I've got a good excuse. I don't need to go to work. People will pamper me and look after me. So I'm going to care for my sickness. I'm not going to try and cure it. It's important for me. I'm not going to try and force it away. Unfortunately, these days, another of my old stories. People go to the doctor, and what do you say when you go to the doctor? There's something wrong with me. I'm sick. Thereby stigmatizing sickness, like we stigmatize sloth and torpor, like we stigmatize restlessness in meditation. Bad meditator. You are restless again. Bad, you're going asleep again. Bad person, you're sick again. There's nothing wrong with being sick. It's part of life. Even people who do yoga and eat healthy food and exercise, they also get sick. Just... In fact, I don't eat healthy food at all, but I'm one of the healthiest monks. I do that just because I'm very, very perverse, I suppose you might call it. I'm a rebel. Trying to prove that it's not just healthy food makes you healthy. I always say, I don't know if I said this before, what is the secret of a long life? The secret of a long life is to drink lots and lots of long life milk. It says it on the... It's obvious, that's why they call it long life milk. You drink it, you have long life. That's the secret. I forget where it was now. I was just thinking of another joke, but I don't know. I've enough jokes this session. the secret of long life. There's nothing wrong with being sick. So many of my disciples, they're well known in the doctor's surgeries of Perth, because they come into the doctor's surgeries and say, "Doctor, there's something right with me. I'm sick again. There's something right with me. The cancer's flared up. There's something right with me. I've got diarrhea. There's something right with..." Going to take away, there's nothing wrong with being sick. They're saying there's something right. It's natural. It's par for the course. So this is actually, even when you are sick, it's important. Don't stigmatize it as something wrong to get rid of. Care for it instead. And if you learn how to care for things, you've got the right relationship to them. Not trying to change them and get rid of them, but caring for them and seeing how they grow by themselves. And how they grow to something very beautiful. So this is what we do with our meditation. We're caring for things rather than trying to cure them. And actually how this actually works, and this is a simile which I often give in the retreats, and I'm going to go through it very quickly, because again, many of these similes you've heard before, but it fits into this particular topic. It's the old simile of the thousand-petal lotus, and how a lotus opens. It's closed during the day, during the night time. And if you ever see a lotus when it's closed, it's this hard bud. There's a lotus over there, it's only a fake one. But, you know, it's a lotus is a symbol in Buddhism. And it's closed up at night time. And the first thing about the closed lotus to notice is that it's got no fragrance, it's not beautiful on the outside petals. In fact, it's all dusty and serrated and a bit dirty. It's very tough too. It's the outermost layer. And what happens in the morning? The sun comes up and the light and the warmth of the sun hit the outermost petal. Some chemical reaction happens and the outermost petal opens. And that allows the next layer of petals to receive the light and warmth of the sun. So they open. Allowing the third, or second, whichever you count it, say the third layer of petals to receive the warmth of the light of the sun, and that opens up. They open up one after the other. When one opens up, the one inside can now receive the light and warmth of the sun and can open up in turn. And the outermost petal is not promising at all. It's just like all these people who come on my meditation retreats. They're very hopeless. You look on the outside, you know, just really hopeless, restless, negative, complaining, all sorts of... But on the inside of you, you open you out and you've got the most fragrant, beautiful petals inside you. That's what I learned from that guy with all the tattoos. You know, got jhanas on the outside. No, no way he can meditate. Just the roughest of outermost petals. But when he opened up, wow, incredible beauty and fragrance and bliss inside of him. So that's actually what we're doing here in meditation. We're opening up the lotus, that is you. And even in the most unpromising lotuses, every lotus has beautiful petals on the inside. Fragrant ones, incredible ones on the inside. You just need to open it up. So how do you open up the lotus? The warmth and the light of the sun. In this simile, what does the warmth and light represent? The light is mindfulness, awareness. Giving this layer of petals importance. Being aware of it. And the warmth is the kindness. Those two, mindfulness and kindness, are what open up the lotus that is your body and mind. You know, I coined the word for that, kindfulness, putting mindfulness and kindness together. You know, I invented that word, and now they're actually, people are teaching kindfulness courses in psychology. Someone actually sent me a link to one of those kindfulness courses. It was very nice, the word is getting some traction. And mindfulness and kindness, and that's what opens up the lotus, and that's all you ever do. So any of you who ever get to a stage of meditation, what do I do next? That whole question is a stupid question. It's what you're doing now. And what are you doing now? Because there's no next in meditation. It's what you're doing now. As long as you're being aware and being kind. Mindfulness and kindness. Now most important time, thing in front of you, most important, just to care, be kind. That is what opens up the lotus. Emperor's three questions, opening up lotuses, and you find this is what happens. You're sitting here, haven't slept much last night, feel really tired, really awful. Be just aware. Give your tiredness value, importance, and just care for it. It opens up. You're not tired anymore. You're just aware of your body. It opens up. Inside the body is your mind. But the mind is lots of thoughts, lots of stuff going on. You open up in the middle of time. That's where the present moment is. Time opens up. And you're right in this moment. And this moment, just with this moment, inside this moment, that's actually where you find the breath. And inside the breath opens up, just being mindful, being kind to your breath. And you become like the full awareness of the breath. See the whole breath, beginning to end. Easy, no problem at all. It opens up the delightful, beautiful breath. Wow, this is so nice. That's, you know, getting into the fragrant, the beautiful petals. You're just watching this delightful breath. Just, it's important. Don't worry about nimittas. This right now is the most important thing in the whole world. Just this delightful breath you're watching. You're just being kind to it, caring for it. And that opens up, and you get nimittas. Wow, amazing. Incredible, beautiful petals. And what do? You start controlling them and you'll fall all the way back to the beginning. The lotus closes, closes, closes all at once. And don't do that, you're doing fine. I don't know why it is that people, you know, they follow the instructions up to nimittas, and when it gets to nimittas, that's when you get involved and just start messing around. It works so far, carry on. Nimittas, most important thing in the world, just this nimitta right now, care for it. It opens up into the big limiter. Wow, beautiful, single light, incredibly powerful, not moving anywhere, just like the moon and the sun, blinding in its power, but not harmful at all. Huge amounts of energy. Just as important, just care for it. And then whoosh, it opens up, and inside there, you find the first jhana. And people sometimes ask, even if they haven't achieved any jhana, haven't even got a nimitta yet, people still ask, well, how do you get from the first jhana to the second jhana? But anyway, the answer is, you know, the second jhana is right inside the first jhana. It's like the layer of petals. It just opens up, and then inside is the second jhana. Opens up inside the third jhana, inside the fourth jhana. Inside the fourth jhana is the immaterial attainments. And you go right through the four immaterial attainments, and inside the last layer of petals, the immaterial attainments, inside that is what the Tibetans call the jewel in the heart of the lotus. Om Mani Padme Hum. Mani is the jewel, Padme in the lotus. Why is that their favourite sort of mantra? And even if you're not a Tibetan Buddhist, you know that one. Om Mani Padme Hum. Why? It's a lotus symbol, because inside the last layer of petals, there you'll find the jewel in the centre of the lotus. And you know what that is? Even though you don't even know what jhana is yet, I will tell you, the jewel in the heart of the lotus. Ajahn Chah told you it through me yesterday. There's nothing. There's nothing. The jewel in the heart of the lotus is emptiness. Nothing. But as soon as you say that, people say, ah, nothing. Nothing is something really important. I already mentioned the story of Alice in Wonderland. There's another story from the suttas. There is this, one of the Buddha's chief monks was called Aniruddha. And Aniruddha, he had some incredible karma from the past. Because in his previous life he did some great act of generosity, the result of which was, in his life when he met the Buddha, he would never ever hear the word, there aren't any. Whatever he wanted, he'd always have. And as a young kid, he was playing marbles with his friends. And he was betting his lunch, which was some cakes. And he lost. So being from a wealthy family, he sent his servant, go and get some more cakes from mum. So his servant went back and bought some more cakes in a basket. And he lost them as well. Get some more. And so his servant came back a third time with some cakes. Remember, everything in Buddhism is done three times. And he lost them a third time. So he went back to his mum's, he sent his servant back to his mum's house. And his mum told him, so we've run out of cakes. There aren't any cakes left. So the servant went back with the empty basket, about to tell him there aren't cakes. And the Pali word for there aren't any is called natti. Natti. So he's going to say to his master, Aniruddha, natti cakes, there aren't any cakes. But because of the karma from his previous life, you know, anything he wanted he had to have. And so the devas, they thought, wow, we can't allow the law of karma to be broken. We have to intervene. So like sometimes part of the job of devas is to ensure the law of karma is always upheld. Like, you know, policemen. So what they did, what can we do? We can't let this young man find out there aren't any cakes because that's against the karma from the past. So they inserted some heavenly cakes. And so when the servant came in the basket without the servant knowing. So when the servant came to see his master Aniruddha with the covered basket, he said, natty cakes. And so Aniruddha took the basket and opened it up, and there's the most delicious cakes he'd ever had in his life. And he said, wow, all these years my mother's been hiding these things from me. My mother doesn't really love me. Now, from now on, I only want to eat natty cakes. And that's just like the jewel in the heart of the lotus. There isn't anything there. Ah, nothing. The most amazing thing you can have, but nothing cakes. They're more delicious than ordinary cakes. So we always like to try and make something out of nothing. But in the middle of the lotus, the jewel. Nothing there. There's nothing. Do you understand? No, you don't. But one day you open up the lotus and there it is, totally empty. And that's really cool. So, that is actually how we meditate. It is not the object you're watching. That is not important. How you watch the object, that's important. The relationship you have to your meditation object. That is going to make you successful or not successful. Even as an aside, because I've been talking to a lot of people with cancer recently. I think I told you about Ajahn Mamani's brother on the first night, sister rather. Years and years ago, in Malaysia, I was being driven from one city to another city, a number of people, but in the back was an oncologist. And she said she was about to retire, been in the business all her life. And she said that now, after all that experience, and this is, I remember she telling me this, it was really important, because that's why I remember it. She was someone on the, you know, the coal face of cancer, treating so many people. That was her profession, a specialist. And she told me that now, when people come into her rooms, you know, for some consultation about their cancer, she doesn't even need to look at the biopsies or the stage and type of their cancer. She can tell 95% certainty who's going to survive and who's going to die just because of their attitude. And she, you know, she said that with such power. You know, she said it's not the stage of the cancer or the type of the cancer which is the problem. It's one's attitude, one's relationship to that cancer, basically. And I've, many of you know, I do a lot of work with the Cancer Support Association over in Cottesloe. I went to the opening of their new campus as a VIP to actually open the place for them. And sort of they say the same thing. It's not the cancer that kills you, it's your relationship you have with it. Same with the meditation. It's not just how much effort you put in. It's not even the type of meditation object you choose. It's how you watch that meditation object. Are you doing it with force? I'm going to watch the breath. If I let it go, it'll just go all over the place. You never get anywhere that way. But if you're kind to whatever you're watching, giving importance, now the most important time, that produces amazing results. That's actually how a person gets into deep meditation. So have a look with the relationship you have with your meditation object, and that will solve a lot of your problems. Sadhu! 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 Okay, have a wonderful morning. But you don't have to. You can be miserable if you want. And please don't forget, this evening, it is the nuns' show. So would you also do the chanting as well at 10 to 8?